Now, we've been discussing the causes of the Reformation, and I've been discussing with you the sale of offices. Equally distressing and equally troublesome was the sale of dispensations. Now, that is not an indulgence. A dispensation confers the privilege of having the powers of an act removed which has been in contrary to church law. A dispensation can be obtained for many things. I have a friend in Salisbury who was a former Roman Catholic, a member of the Cistercian order, and a monk up at the St. Norbert's in Minnesota, Wisconsin.
Wisconsin.
Okay. And he got his degree in English, and he fell in love with a fellow student, a Lutheran girl, very fine girl, and he got a dispensation from the Pope to leave the order. But they don't have Friday specials in that, and to leave the order, it costs money. Now, at the end of the Middle Ages, they had all sorts of things. For instance, you could, if you were a first cousin, wanted to marry a girl, your first cousin, for a price of about $8 today, you could get dispensation to marry her. But if an uncle wanted to marry his niece, and the niece was willing to marry an uncle, it would cost $240, 30 times more than the $8. In other words, both of those marriages would be within the limited, within the prohibited degrees of consanguinity. Therefore, but the church would let you do it if you were willing to pay. Now, since people want to do those things, and since many people want to get rid of their wives or husbands and be free from monastic vows and so on, this was a lucrative source of income. But by no means would the sale of dispensations or the sale of church offices provide enough money to run the huge bureaucracy which was the Roman Church. And so they developed the sale of indulgences. I've mentioned that before, did I not? But now I want to look upon it from its technical point of view. This was probably the most gross of all the ecclesiastical and religious problems, because it was a huge, today we call it a multi-million dollar business. I point out to you that after 1300, the old idea of indulgence, of going on a crusade or doing something, or entering a monastery, went by the board, because those things, those activities, did not help the papal treasury. But if you paid cash for an indulgence, that was another thing. And so that was the early day. Now I went over the sacraments. I don't need to go over that again with you, but the indulgence was the capstone. Instead of going on a crusade, instead of entering a monastery, instead of doing this other thing, you want me? Instead of all, what did you do? You paid cash down to the priest, or in that day, to those who hawked the indulgences. Now, in common practice, although not technically in the eye of the church in the sense that it was written down, the people believed that a total indulgence brought you total pardon for all past sins committed, and also a license to commit sins. In other words, if you bought a good indulgence, it not only gave forgiveness for the past, but you could for the next year sin in safety. It's what you might call ecclesiastical term insurance. Now, granted, this was not the official teaching of church, but in practice, in the practice of people who bought them, and the practice of priests who sold them, and in the, shall we say, the sales pitch of those special sellers of indulgence, this is the way, you see, if you could tell a person, listen, you can send all your previous sins are forgiven, all sins for next year forgiven, just pay me cash down for this indulgence, who wouldn't buy term insurance? Because if the end of next year you're still alive, what you could do? Do it over again. But every time you did it, you paid for it. You see? A dispensation was a permission to escape from some provision of canon law, namely in regard to marriage, in regard to obtaining a permission to leave a monastic order, or the priesthood, or a marriage situation, anything you commit yourself to, which you didn't particularly care for, was subject to the seal of a dispensation. The most common were permissions to leave a monastic order and permissions to marry within the forbidden degrees of consanguinity.
So one was canon law and one was moral law?
Canon law embraces moral law. In other words, the canon law first put out about the year, at the famous school of Bologna, about the year 1000, had what we call provisions for the government of the church, the role of the bishops, the role of the priests, the role of so and so and so on, and the moral law, and all other provisions of the relations of church and state. It's a great collection of canons, and it's known as canon law. A lot of it is based upon Roman law, but not all of it. It does contain biblical law also. But it also contains the interpretation of the canons of biblical law that grew up around this law school at Bologna, groups of lawyers who became canonists. In other words, they were the authority, they were kind of the Supreme Court, and the Pope could refer a case to the canon, the lawyers at around Bologna. A very famous one was Ivo of Chartres. In the 11th century, he was associated with the cathedral school up there. But there, the law school at Bologna was the famous law school of medieval Europe. It was not until later, the time of the Renaissance and Reformation, that the school, law school of Orléans became very famous. But almost all the medieval canon lawyers and civil lawyers for various kings studied law at Bologna. Okay. Indulgence was forgiveness for sins.
The one is permission and the other is forgiveness.
Right. Exactly right. Now, by the time of Leo X, the need for money had become so acute that they developed a new system. The Pope farmed out the collection of indulgences to the greatest banking house of the day. The house of J.F. Fugger and Company of Augsburg, which was the J.P. Morgan, it was the Bank of America, it was the Chase Manhattan Bank of its day. And they got trained sellers of indulgences. They used the Dominican order, and the Pope named these men who would be released from their particular duties with the order, and they were trained to sell indulgences. Now, let us say a man bought an indulgence for $300. Fugger and Company charged 33 and 30% to sell it. and the papers would get a third, and somebody else would get a third, depending on how his hand in the puddle. By this time, the indulgence was regarded as a veritable and virtual passport to heaven that St. Peter could not refuse. Now, later we'll see, and we'll come to Martin Luther, as I hope to today, that Fugger and Company sent Tetzel up to sell a particular indulgence in Germany. Basically, the Archbishop of Hamburg wanted to buy two other bishoprics. He didn't have enough money to do it. So he was granted the right to receive the income, or one-third the income, from the indulgence, which was sold. And Tetzel was a professional seller. It's estimated he made about $17,000 to $20,000 a year. He had a cart drawn by oxen, and he had a mechanical thing in the back, and he lowered a tailgate, and there was the altar. It was a traveling altar. And he got up, and he had a sermon. I will read it to you later. And he preached a sermon. Have you ever read it? Have you read it?
No, but I keep just trying to picture it.
It was something. What actually happened was, in 1464, the Pope of the day was so bad, the Pope was so bad, and had the Domenici slur. he made the sale of indulgences retroactive to all those in purgatory. Now, up until that time, that had not been the case. But from that moment on, you could buy your ancestors out of purgatory, or you could reduce the time which they had to spend in purgatory. Now, when you think of all the loyal members of the church that died from the year 1 on down, down to 1464, and down to 1520, imagine them all. The availability of income was immeasurable. He simply opened a whole new market for the sale of indulgences, but would be paid for this by the living, who also buy their own. Now, Tetzel was a super salesman. He was sent up there because he was a super salesman. He was like the Fuller Brush Man. He got his foot in the door, and boy, you've had. He also didn't have very good sense, but that's not the point. And very clear, license to sin, at least for a year, and they graded them. For instance, if you committed murder, that was very expensive. It might be 10,000 guilders or 1,000 guilders. But if you only shot the eye out of a man, it wouldn't be that much. If you ran away with a man's wife, that would be serious, but wouldn't be that. It might be 500 guilders. And if you destroyed the virtue of a girl, that was less yet. If you stole from the beggar, that wasn't too much. But the whole series of grades. Now, again, not only were there sins graded, but also who committed them. If a prince killed a man, well, you could give him the works. But if a peasant killed him, you wouldn't charge him much. And if a peasant was really broke, you'd forgive him for nothing. There were cases where they didn't charge anything, because they knew they couldn't get anything if they did charge him. And they gave him the comfort of having been forgiven. They charged according to that seriousness crime, and they charged according to the ability to pay on the part of the one who committed the sin. And when you take these two into consideration, for the living and for the sin and for the souls of all those residing in purgatory, the source of income for the papers was vastly increased, particularly when you have such able salesmen on the road as Fugger and Company, who actually used monks, Dominican monks, to do it. That's all they did. They traveled around, Tetzel traveled around Europe in this ox cart selling indulgences. He wasn't the only one, but he was the one that broke into the history of the bang, because he tangled with Luther and Count Frederick, Duke Frederick of Saxony. Do you see the point? Now, this caused problems. Well, Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, remember the Pardoner's Tale? Well, he poured scorn on that sort of thing. Another source of irritation from among the more learned and more thinking people was the veneration of Rolex. This was a crying shame, but it was also a part of the whole money-making deal. For instance, this practice came in about the 5th century, somewhere at the death of Augustine. It came to be believed that relics, objects used by Christ or the Virgin Mary or the apostles, had a peculiar value and a peculiar therapeutic ability. To put it in other words, they had a peculiar and a particular healing ability, a miraculous ability to heal. Now, once you have that as firmly established, you have another great marker.
Well, they went one step further than that, any of the bones from the catacombs.
Well, sure, the bones of the catacombs. I'm just giving a few of them. Well, there were no less than 5 shin bones of the ass upon which Christ rode to Jerusalem on display in Europe. That would have been a rough ride. A 5-legged donkey. There were no less than 12 heads of John the Baptist on this plant. No wonder Herod was afraid of him. Erasmus, who in this sense must probably be trusted, said there was enough wood from the true cross to float a ship over Europe. In other words, if you went around Europe, you'd find enough fragments of the true cross to build a ship. In a pamphlet in which Martin Luther, with his usual bombastic and very pointed style, lampooned the Archbishop of Mainz, he said the Archbishop of Mainz, I'm quoting, claimed to possess a whole pound of the wind that blew for Elijah in the cave of Mount Horeb, and he also had in his possession 2 feathers and 1 egg off the Holy Ghost. Now, with my father one time, because he had a pass on the railroad, we took a trip up to New York and up to Boston and then up to Canada on the Canadian Pacific Road, which the pass was honored. And we took a bus ride from Quebec out to St. Anne de Beaupré, which is a very noted cathedral. Think of Jim Baker having letters come in piled on a desk and praying of the letters. And it smacks the same type of a practice. I don't mean to be nasty, but to me, it's almost as gross, because they always say, now send $25 in, or some other appropriate thing. Now, they don't say that this will remove the sins, but I mean, the inference is that the prayer without the money will not be as effective as the prayer with the money. I may be cruel, I don't mean to be, but I don't like it. But all the time I think of indulgences and what happened to the Roman Church. Now, they could get away with in that day for this reason. The average peasant, the average burgher in France, Germany, England, whatnot, they seldom went 15 or 25 miles away from home. Do you realize that the average Mr. Joe Blow in medieval Europe hardly ever went, unless he went in the crusade, hardly ever went 50 miles away from home? So if you had the head of John the Baptist up in say, Magdeburg or Bremen, another one down in Vienna, they wouldn't know the difference. And you had a few others nicely sparse between Paris and Budapest, and London. They never knew the difference. They think that was a true cross. They think that was Luther said it, they even professed to have some of the original hair of the Virgin Mary and a few strands of her dress, which may be doubted. Now, having traced with you the ecclesiastical and the religious problems, and they were many, and they were vital, and they were deep. Let's look now at the doctrinal issues. You see, the question emerges, why could these abuses creep within the church? Why was it possible for such abuses to creep within the church? Why was it possible? Well, the answer is this. Particularly from 1200 on, there has been a great departure from the Augustine theology. You see, I point out to you the sacramental system could not have developed if the church had remained true to St. Augustine. These abuses could not have come in the church if the church had remained true to St. Augustine. If grace is invisibly received through the sacraments and itself is invisible, how is it possible that the marriage of relics will saw off your stay in purgatory, or the buying indulgences will reduce your stay in purgatory? Because that's a work of grace itself. In other words, these abuses and all the financial abuses attending them could not have taken place if they had remained true to the Augustine heritage. And you say, well, what about Jim Baker? Ah. I would say the same thing. I'm not saying they're not Christian, but that type of charismatic, and I phrase it that way, that particular group of charismatics have seriously departed from historic Orthodox Christian faith. I'm not saying they're unbelievers. I'm saying that as I see them over TV, the kind of preaching they do, the kind of invitation which they use, and the kind of practices in which they indulge, that they have departed far from the heritage of the church. They have not held on to Augustine doctrine, perhaps any more than the Roman church did in its day, although the abuses are different to a degree, but they're there. Which is to say then, that in my opinion, and this is after many and many years of study, that the basic issue in the church was theological, was doctrinal. The descent from Augustinism into semi-Pelagianism, and in many cases Platonism, invites that. You see, all Pelagianism, all Arminianism insists that man can cooperate with God, and that the mode of cooperation is always good works. For later medieval church, that mode of cooperation was in payments, in veneration of relics, in buying indulgences, and as it had been in the early Middle Ages, in going to crusades, fasting, entering monasteries, and other forms of self-denial. Now you paid out cash, because that was coming into prominence. The currency, instead of feudal service, was now the mainstay of the economic system. Now, that could not have taken place if the doctrines of grace had remained intact and pure. I point out to you that St. Thomas gave a great impetus to this departure, but and after his death, the departure became worse. The Pelagianism became much more pronounced. The iniquities of indulgences became much more rapid. The veneration of relics became more widespread with a money payment. All of this was a downhill departure. Downhill. And this is what happened. Now, therefore, Augustine theology had no longer retained its prestigious place in the thinking of the church. Now, there were Augustinians. To varying degrees, the bread of the common life were Augustinian. To varying degrees, and to a greater degree probably, Thomas Bradwardine in the Church of England was, I should say the Roman Church in England. Certainly John Collet was at St. Paul. Certainly John Wycliffe was in England. Certainly John Huss was in Prague. It was there, but they were scattered all over the theological, ecclesiastic globe, so to speak. And they did not have a unified voice. They were in different countries. They came at different times. And because they were not unified, the papers could put John Huss down, Jerome of Prague down, so on. But by 1500, the issues had become so pronounced. The theological underlying, or should say the theological problem, had become more manifest. By 1500, through the grace of God, that alone, men within the church were realizing that you could not cure the abuses until you reformed the theology. Now, Huss and Wycliffe attacked certain Roman doctrines. notably, of course, the mass. They attacked the law of the clergy. And they put forward a, what we might call the a reform view of the of the Sacrament of the Lord's Supper. But they didn't do it lock, stem, and thorn. They only did part of it. The Reformation demanded a Reformation of the whole. And so there were doctrinal issues. And to cut short what I want to say, the Reformation was a revival of Augustine theology. I made a study, which I have never published, so I intend to someday, I guess, of St. Augustine and John Calvin. And John Calvin quoted and or paraphrased St. Augustine about 400 times in the Institutes alone. That's a tremendous number. So much so that Charles Hodge, writing in the 1860s and 70s, in his systematic theology, made it very clear that he regarded the Reformation as Augustinianism revived. He calls it that in his theology. Now, that's all I think I have to say. That essentially, now they went beyond Augustine in some places, but essentially, the Reformation was a revival of Augustinianism. And all that which that was and all that which that involved.
I've heard it said that Augustine was the author of all that was good in the Reformation.
That's right.
And also a lot of the bad that was in the church.
That's partly true and partly false. The Roman church clung to the early Augustine. if you take his writings from 395, 397, and his conversion on to 430, you will see that in the first, let's say, 12 to 15 years, you can claim him with some problems involved, but if you take him from the De Civitate Dei on, from 412 to 430, the last 18 years of his life, it's pretty hard to claim him. Now, it's not fair to claim the unfinished Augustine. And I mean the unfinished Augustine, the man who was still developing the Christian faith. Now, I admit that the later development, it was inherent in the first 12 or 13 years, but it was not completed. It was not finished. It was not brought to its fullness. But you take with the City of God, and gentlemen, I've read the City of God. I read it in Latin. I've read it in English. If you take the City of God, and then you take his later works, which I gave to you. Well, I did to a degree in this course, but in historical theology, I had to go into depth. When you take his predestination of saints, for instance, and against the other people, his Calvinism, if you want to use that word, comes out in stark clarity. There's no way of mixing the two. And the Roman Church simply overlooks that.
Well, what were some of the leading bad things that were supposed to be laid to him?
Well, they claim him for the sacramental system, which is totally false. They claim him for the apostolic succession, which is totally false because he got in a fierce combat with the bishops of Rome, and nice biblical language. He put them in their place. Let me put it this way: in the earlier works, down to 410, 412. There was an attempt. Well, let me say it for now. There was the lingering element of his Neoplatonism in his works, and his early reference to the Trinity. This is true. His early discussions of God. This is true. A lingering concept of what we call logos philosophy, logos theology. But when he wrote his great work, De Trinitate, on the Trinity, that's all gone. When he wrote his great city of God, the city of the sovereignty of God, the greatness of God, the glory of God, the electing power of God, the predestination of God, the demands of holiness of God, are all there in clarity. He blames the fall of Rome on the moral class of the Roman people, and sets in contrast that the biblical requirements for holiness, righteousness. There's a good book, I'll tell you a good book to read on this. I don't know what's available. I think it's still in print. It's an excellent work. Charles Norris Cochran and Classical Culture. And Augustine is the focal point of that whole book. Now he treats Tertullian, he treats other church fathers, but the main thrust is Augustine. And he makes this very clear. If you'll get a hold of Van Til's works on Augustine, and you get them from Westminster Seminary up in Philadelphia, you can get it also. You're welcome. James.
So how is the method of his interpretation of the Bible?
Pardon me? Say it again. Do you mind?
Augustine's interpretation of the Bible method?
how did he do it? This is a place where in his early works he in a sense aided the Roman Church. He still relied upon allegory. Now allegory had been used in the medieval church, had been used in the Eastern Church as a means of giving a spiritual meaning to mundane events. It's one of the three or four hermeneutical methods employed by the medieval church. And it came from Augustine. But the medieval church misused in a way which Augustine did not. Again, with the city of God, Augustine begins to understand and to use what we call the grammatical historical approach to in Scripture. In his later works, his work in the Trinity, his work in the predestination of saints, and the many other works, on his great work on law and grace, it's all gone. The Roman Church uses those portions, early portions of Augustine, which it likes, and forgets his great works. Have I made that clear to both of you gentlemen? I appreciate your questions. I'm very glad to answer them. I've read, I think, everything Augustine wrote, including his letters. I'm not saying a bragging man. I do it because I'm a church historian, teach historical theology, and I've got to know what I'm talking about. And I've read Charles Norris Cochran several times, too. You might want to read that book.
Hodges' book. We're just starting to read that one.
Systematic, Volume 1. that's what you call light reading. No, it's quite heavy. It's a very good systematic theology, however. Three volumes.
Which one?
Three volumes. Charles Hodge. Did you do that reform? Did you?
No, I read him when.
For Mr. Smith, Professor Dr. Smith.
No.
The whole three volumes?
No, we're starting with volume 2.
Oh, good. Oh, you are? That's all right. Now, let's go now to the Renaissance as a cause of the Reformation. And you say, what? Can secular humanism aid the cause of a sovereign God? My answer is a thundering and absolute yes. Why? Because God, he sovereignly uses all means to promote his own glory. Even though men may be in rebellion, they laugh at the Lord, but the Lord holds them in derision, says the psalmist. Yes, they did. Now, does anyone debate that with me? All right, let's go on. Out of it now. In the first place, the Renaissance said, the motto of the Renaissance was back to the sources, back to the sources, back to the sources. Okay, that's fine. Back to Latin and Greek and Hebrew. Now, Latin is not necessarily dynamite, unless Latin would recover Augustine, that was pure dynamite. But when you go back to the Greek of the New Testament, when Reuchlin said, let's go back to the Hebrew of the Old Testament, when Lefebvre goes back to the Greek of the New and the Hebrew of the Old, and when William Bude goes back to the Greek of the Old New and the Greek and the Hebrew of the Old, when these men, like the Oxford Reformers, Lineker, Brooklyn, and Colette, when they go back, when they go back to the original Greek, that was dynamite. Gentlemen, when you're doing Greek New Testament name, and you think I'm rough, and I am, I admit the charge, please remember that it was this very type of approach which helped to produce the Reformation. And when Professor Martin Smith or somebody wants to know the Hebrew that way, please remember that Reuchlin set a fire in Germany with the revival of the Hebrew. He set a fire in France with the revival of the Hebrew, along with Jacques Lefebvre. These men, brilliant linguists, furnished the Reformers with the ammunition which they needed, the Greek New Testament, Hebrew Old Testament, and a better translation of the Latin Fathers. Luther knew the church fathers better than his opponents did, which became very evident at Leipzig when he engaged in debate with John Eck. Calvin knew the church fathers better than his opponents did, which is quite evident in his Institutes of Christian Religion. These men knew their history, and they knew the Greek and the Hebrew. So back to the sources, a great crowd of humanists became a hand grenade, exploded in their faces. It went right back to them and undermined their own cause. Secondly, the outbreak of the Renaissance made it easier for the Reformers to speak their peace, so to speak, made it more difficult for the church to harass them. Now, the church did, but and it did particularly in some places, but the Reformers had, an audience which John Huss never had. John Huss preached around Bohemia, notably around Jerusalem Chapel in Prague. Wycliffe did travel some, but mostly around University of England, Oxford. These men did not travel around. They didn't have that wide audience Reformers had. On the whole, Toller did in Germany, aren't they? And to a degree that Brother the Common Life did, where they had their schools. But the reformers could speak more openly. After all, after 1520, they could look at Martin Luther, and the papers didn't dare do anything to Martin Luther. It gave them courage. Thirdly, the great technical advance of the Renaissance, the discovery of the printing press, was a tremendous advantage. When John Huss was preaching, there was no printing press to put out pamphlets of what he said. When Wycliffe was in England, he had no printing press. But almost overnight, when, yes?
Going back to your last.
Sure. Oh, it's all right.
About their freedom to speak.
I yeah.
Was Luther the first one to have that Wycliffe?
Yes, he was. Lefebvre had to flee from Paris for voicing his opinions. And others had to flee, Tyndall in Great Britain. Luther was the first one to really, shall we say, get away with it. Because Duke Frederick of Saxony was a very wise man. He's often called Frederick the Wise. He was also very zealous of his own province. And while he said, I'm a good Roman Catholic, but don't interfere in my province. and he was very fond of Martin Luther personally. He was very proud of him.
I guess I'm not sure why John Huss perhaps couldn't have put together some
Well, the Emperor Sigismund, who had promised them safe conduct to Constantine, after he got there, revoked it.
Yeah. I guess I'm wondering what happened around 1500.
All right. this is a good question. The abuses which were coming into view in 1400 became more and more evident as the century wore on, as the papacy now had the great schism with the popes excommunicating each other, with the failure of the councils, with the advent of people like Alexander VI, with his plot and counterplot and skull and dagger deal, with the sale of indulgences, the action of Sixtus IV and making them retroactive into purgatory. All these things, I mean, it was a culminating effect. And another thing, the 14th century laid the foundation for the strong, I mean, the 15th century laid the foundation for the strong governments of the 16th century. England had the War of the Roses. They were brought to an end in 1485, and out of the War of the Roses came Henry VII, who was a very strong ruler. His son had all the building, Henry VIII. In France, the wars of the 15th century culminated in the triumph of the Capetian monarchy, or I should say the house of the Capetian monarchy in Louis the XI. So that for the first time, with the defeat of Charles the Bold of Burgundy, France had a unified monarchy. They never had it before. France now had a strong monarchy, and Francis I inherited it. Germany, which had gone through the throes of the houses battling each other over the imperial elections, by this time, the Habsburgs were in firm control. And Germany was becoming more and more unified. France was, and England was. And you have in the 15th century the development of national sentiment in France and in Germany and England. As that national sentiment developed, the people who enjoyed it were more and less, more and more in opposition to papal claims, papal taxation, so and so. You see? And then Huss was a good preacher. And it had some magnetism. Rome of Prague was nothing less than heroic. Both of them burned the stake. Wycliffe was a good preacher. Whether he's more influential than Huss is an academic matter, I don't know. But nothing they did was as dramatic as Martin Luther with those 95 theses. Sheer drama, Hollywood had nothing to compare with ever. A great preacher, a very able theologian, and today we say he had a large dose of charisma. I'm sure that had to be true. Now, my third point was this, that the advent of the printing press bill made the big difference. The men I've mentioned had no printing press. No way to make their views widespread. Within a very few days, the old Gutenberg press, thundering heavy machinery at the University of Wittenberg, was busy turning out thousands of copies of his three addresses, the address to Christendom building, so I'll discuss a little there. Nothing like it. Never before. The burghers of Wittenberg, the burghers in the other town, Leipzig, this is what Martin Luther says. We like it. Frederick Roeder read it and loved it. Von Staupitz helped to inspire it, and he loved it. The Pope read it, and he didn't like it. See my point? In these three ways, without ever intending to, the Renaissance aided the coming of the Reformation. And of course, in a fourth way, you could say, the Renaissance let loose a storm of secular criticism against the papacy, Erasmus being the leader of that. And Sir Thomas More, in his Utopia, being another leader of it. Sir Thomas More was a thoroughgoing a totalitarian, however, and a socialist. And I do not think, in spite of the fact he's been sanctioned by the church, that he was a believing Christian. I don't have time to go into that today or any other time, frankly.
Someone said that he wrote that the book Utopia.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they said
that he did, yes. Okay,
the
Augustine's
book was also when Utopia.
You mean the City of God? Yeah. That was Utopia. But it was based upon what?
Scripture.
Right. What? Therefore, I do not like the word utopia. The word, you know what the word utopia means, don't you?
From two Greek words.
Meaning nowhere.
One meaning nowhere and other meaning
everywhere. Yes. See, the City of God closes with this. Homia ad gloriam Dei referenda est. All things must be referred to the glory of God. Gratia et electio, essentia et mysterium historiae. Grace and election are the essence and mystery of history. That's not utopia. For Augustine, if you want to use the word, the new heaven and new earth brought in by the second coming of Jesus Christ are the utopia. But they're not nowhere. They're everywhere. I rebel against those who call Augustine utopian. His City of God is the greatest exposition of the meaning of history ever written, and its application to history to his day. But the principles contained in books, books 20, 21, 22, but all through the thing, really apply to the interpretation of history in our day. He paints that tremendous picture of the coming, the second coming of Jesus Christ, which is akin to that found in Revelation. And because God works throughout history, the church is the center of human history, around which all things revolve throughout history. And it is the center of history. It's the birth of Jesus Christ, as described in Galatians 4, 3 and 4, is the very center of history. When the fullness of time has come, that's not more utopia. It's tremendous. Magnificent. I beg of you, I almost get down my knees and urge you to read the City of God. Hopefully you would do it in Latin. But if Latin is not your first native language, do it in English. Now, Bill led me into my next course, and that was the growth of national consciousness. But let me put it to you this way. To answer your question, in the 14th century, it was nothing like what happened in the 16th century. In the 15th century, did not have what came about in the 16th century. The almost simultaneous appearance of three great national leaders, who, in their respective ways, with their respective abilities, embodied the national consciousness of England, France, and Germany. For centuries, since Frederick Barbarossa, Germany had not had a Charles V. I would say that France had not had a man like Francis I since Philip II, 1180 to 1223. Oh, well, yes. Louis the Ninth, 1223-1272. But that was 250 years. England had not had a ruler like Henry the Eighth since Edward the Second, 1327. Suddenly, there appears out of the sky, so to speak, three very able rulers beating the breast, oh, we're Roman Catholic, we're loyal to your Pope. Don't ever doubt our loyalty. But wait a minute. Don't butt your nose into my business in Germany. And Francis, we're going to limit your power in France. And then he said, come to Italy, come to England at your peril. And he finally, he said, forget it. We're no longer Roman Catholic, English Catholic. I'm the new Pope. Now, I'm sort of being funny about it, but I'm also being very serious. Pope Henry originally had no intention of breaking from Rome doctrinally. And only when the Pope refused to grant the divorce did it happen. But you see, you must remember that Catherine of Aragon happened to be very dear to the heart of Charles V. In fact, she was his aunt. And Charles V had a very high view of marriage in general, and of his aunt's marriage in particular. So that when when Henry VIII went to divorce Catherine, and they approached Leo X about, Julius II about a marriage, Leo X, you know what happened? Charles V said, yes, if this happens, it will be the last act you do on earth, Leo X. And Leo got the message. And Leo got very scrupulous. He got very intensely moral for the first time in his life. Because I can't possibly grant that divorce. So Henry said, okay, if that's the way it is, I'll get it other ways, which he did. But the papers now, in 1200, it would have been unthinkable for the English king to conduct himself in that manner. And the people would not have stood for it. But in
1520, 1525, 1526?
Was Charles V? Charles V was the nephew of Catherine of Aragon. That's what I mean by that. You see, national consciousness has played a strong part. You see, as the monarchies became stronger and stronger, they wanted to do the appointing power. They wanted to appoint the archbishops. They wanted to appoint the bishops. They wanted to appoint the abbots of monasteries. And this was a tremendous source of conflict. Henry VIII wanted to appoint the Archbishop of Canterbury. He wanted to appoint the Archbishop of York. He wanted to appoint the Bishop of Lincoln. In fact, he wanted to appoint all the bishops as they became vacant. And he didn't mind making a few vacancies. Of course, another source of tremendous conflict, this was true in Germany also, true in France, another source of conflict was the claim, which they had successfully defended thus far, that all property, all church property, was free from taxation. Now, in England and in France and Germany, within a few percentage points, about one third of the land in each of these countries was held by the church, which meant that one third of the land was free from taxation. Now let me give you a mathematical illustration. Let's suppose that the king of England is going to levy a tax of £100,000 on England, of all being land. All right. If the clergy paid a share, the clergy would pay a third, the royalty would pay a third, and the common people would pay a third. But suppose the clergy doesn't pay a share of 33 1/3%. What happens? An extra 16.5% goes to the royalty, the baron, so an extra 16.3% of the common people. You see, increase their share of the taxation by 50% each of the other two groups. You know what? Curiously, they didn't like it. And they were no longer willing to have the clerical lands free from taxation. Because taxation was increasing. As Henry VII built a strong navy, which he did, and as he built a strong government, as he did, he naturally had to have more money. Henry VIII was not exactly noted for his thrifty habits. He built a big army, he strengthened the navy, and he spent a lot of money. He needed income. And so the demand arose for no taxation of, to end the freedom of taxation for the papal land. And this is one of the reasons which brought England into the Reformation. which made Henry stiffen up his back against papal taxation. A third factor in national consciousness was the extension of the claim of the church courts. See, the church courts claimed jurisdiction over all clergy, over all orphans, over all widows, over all the clergy, over any case in which an oath was involved, over any case in which church lands were involved, over any case involving the clergy in civil matters. That didn't leave many cases for the royal courts. But remember, by this time, England had developed the system of courts begun by Henry I and Henry II, the courts of the common law, which were good courts. There was a time when the papal courts were best in Europe. This is no longer true. England had an excellent system of courts. And Henry VII and VIII, in spite of all you can say about them, developed them. But you see, to be good courts and to have popular appeal, they had to infringe upon the papal courts. And the papal didn't like that. You see, you could appeal suppose that you were a peasant in England and you sued for divorce because your wife was unfaithful. And the bishop of the diocese refused it. You could sue to Rome. You paid for it. That's why Henry sued to Rome, tried to get Rome to hear his case, and of course, case on divorce. But when you had a case tried in Rome, to be perfectly fair, the court of Rome was a good court. It had been noted for fair decisions. After you paid for it, but you got what you paid for. Now the court was still good on the whole, but when it claimed jurisdiction of the clergy and over church lands, no, the courts of England were deprived of jurisdiction in a large element of English life. This aroused a great deal of opposition. Another source of opposition was the fact that the church was international in character. See, the church was the Church of Rome in England, the Church of Rome in France, the Church of Rome in Germany, in Spain, in Portugal, in Italy, in Sweden, in Norway, Denmark, Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, Poland, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, and even over into Macedonia. And the Pope was in the middle. If he settled cases which favored the French king, the German emperor would get up on his hind legs. If he settled something to favor the English king, both France and Germany were accusing him of favoritism, you see. And the fact that the Pope was international, or the papers international, at a time when nationalism was becoming strong, created trouble. And in many cases, very real trouble. So far, so good. In 1516, Francis I had a council at the very beginning of his reign in which they seriously limited the papacy at Rome in investing and in the influence of elections of bishops in the French church. They were closing in on papal power. The same thing was true in Germany under Maximilian. Charles V became emperor in 1519, and Francis I in 1515, and of course Henry VIII in 1509. But within the space there of 10 years, these three men came to the throne. Immediately they faced these problems, and they took strong action. Nevertheless, they always complained. They always said, sure, I'm a good Roman Catholic, don't forget me, but I'm loyal to church, except on these various points. Did you have a question? Now, there was an economic problem. Henry VIII is a good example of what I mean. When the taxes went out of England to the papacy, and you must remember that everybody in England paid taxes. They paid what they called a Peter's Pence, which was a household tax every year. Every time a priest was named to a benefice, or a bishop was named to his benefice, they paid what they called annate, which was equal to the first year's income in that particular bishopric. The whole income went to Rome. What happened? Well, the bishop made it from his people. But they didn't pay it with credit cards. They didn't pay it with check. When all this money went out of England to Rome, it went out in the form of gold currency. Thus the papacy got a huge accumulation of gold and became the arbiter of the value of gold. And England resorted to all sorts of tricks. In order to offset this, Henry VIII resorted to what they called clipping. Have you ever heard of that? He'd take a gold coin and clip the edges and make more gold coins, but it would still have the same value, but would have less gold in it. Now, ultimately, this produced inflation. And this is one of the reasons that Henry had his eyes on the church. Right after he proclaimed his independence from the church, you know what he did? He seized all the monastic lands, all the lands of the church in England, and gave it out to poor people, and gave it out to the middle class, and gave it out to his favorites. You see, the poor people who didn't have much land weren't going to get too upset if they got 50 or 100 acres. You could call it a form of bribery, which it was. On the other hand, he did do some good. There's no doubt that Henry VIII wanted to get control of the English church as well, but there's no doubt that he used it wisely on the whole. And he brought an end to papal taxation. All these things produced the problems I've mentioned. Taxation, the drainage of wealth, interference in the courts, interference in national affairs, and so on. There's one other point. By 1500, English was developing as a language. German had developed a language. French was a language. And the popes continued to speak in Latin. The mass was still in Latin. Now, granted, the protest did not come at once, but what happened by 1537 in England? Matthew's Bible came out. Tyndale's Bible. The bishop's Bible came out. What language were they in? English. What language did Luther do his Old New Testament in? German. The 1541 edition of the Institutes was in what language? French. The people wanted the scriptures in their own language. The Pope said no. Luther, Calvin, and so on said yes. Now, have I been clear to you? These are the causes of the Reformation. But remember, superintending all of this, bringing Luther, Calvin, and the others in at the same time, approximately, bringing Francis I, Charles V, and Henry VIII, and at the same time, politically produced a situation which the 15th century reformers did not have. Bringing men at the same time who either knew each other personally or were very conversant with each other's work. Now, Calvin and Luther never met. But Luther and Melanchthon were good friends. and Luther and others of Calvin's retinue, Bucer, they knew. I mean, Bucer. And Bucer knew them. So that there was a coming together of these great thinking minds. Knox knew Calvin. Knox knew Bucer. Knox knew Cranmer. In England. Divine superintendence, divine providence, the divine unfolding of God's will for his church in his own time, in his own way, through his own men. Don't ever, ever, ever forget that, gentlemen. Because while you can give all the sacred causes, you can give all the abuse of the church you want, and I've done it. I've shown my distrust and my distaste for the whole Roman Catholic system. Never deny the Christians in the church. I've done as fairly as I can. I submit that the total understanding can only come if we see with Augustine, omnia thing, omnia ad referendum, referenda gloria Dei est. Omnia referenda ad gloriam Dei est. All things must be referred to the glory of God. Then when you see that, you will see the key to the whole story. Incidentally, you will see the key to history. Das ist alles. Sehr gut. The Lord bless you until we meet again. 2 weeks hence. Auf Wiedersehen, ja. Do you speak German? Sprechen Sie das Deutsch? Oh. Very timely, but I've enjoyed this morning. I hope you have understood and enjoyed this too. Ask more questions, Bill. Ask more questions.
2 weeks.
2 weeks from last night.